Welcome to the American Reformer Podcast, hosted by Josh Abatoy and Timon Klein. Our mission is to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day, rooted in the rich tradition of Protestant social and political thought.
All right. Hello and welcome back to the American Reformer Podcast. It's Josh Abatoy, Executive Director, Timon Klein, Editor-in-Chief, and we have a special guest, a longtime listener, first-time caller, our Director of Education, Colin Redimer. Colin, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's good to be here, Josh. I don't know that I'm a first-time caller. I think before the podcast, there were Twitter spaces, and I was on a few of those.
Yeah, well, we'll grant but a special I don't know if they qualify. So, it's great for you to join us today, and we're going to be talking here about the Cotton Mather Fellowship. Although it is partly a call to people to apply, because we want a lot of applicants and have an extremely competitive process, and we want everybody to try to get in. It's partly that, but it's also partly a broader discussion of formation of rising Christian leaders and your thoughts on that and how you designed the program and curriculum. But this is in many respects your brainchild, Colin. We cooked this up over 2 years ago now. You've run two programs exceptionally successfully, constantly refining it, but want to get it on the table, get our supporters, our listeners, a chance to get behind the hood and see what we're doing, and explain a little bit about the design. So maybe just to start it off, Colin, you can give a little bit of your own background. We typically do this with guests, but tell us a little bit about where you came from, what work you're doing now, and what brought you to the work that you're at with American Reformer.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. I was raised in the main line, actually, which surprises a lot of people when they figure out where I am. But I'm from the First Congregational Church, which was a UCC church, United Church of Christ. And really, my parents were sort of faithful evangelicals in that space. And we watched it sort of drift and fall apart. It's still there, of course, as a building. It's still there financially. I think there's probably some people that are there in that congregation, but it's not the church that it was that I was raised in. And that's really concerning for me. When I was a young adult, I was going into academia, attending various urban church plant, sort of Keller-esque churches, and slowly watched each of those drift away from what we would consider orthodox, traditional Christian faithfulness on things like sexual ethics. That just began convincing me we needed new kinds of ministries, we needed new kinds of leaders, we needed new kinds of institutions in order to maintain evangelical fidelity to the gospel in the coming generations in the United States. And that obviously matters to me as a Christian leader. Matters to me as a parent, and it matters to me as a parishioner, right? I want to faithfully hand on that which I received, as it says in scripture. So besides that, I am an academic, so I teach at a local Catholic college here in the Bay Area, and I'm also the executive director of the Davenant Institute. That's my primary affiliation, and the Davenant Institute is a really excellent place that's doing resourcement work. We offer classes, we publish books, we translate things, and the work the Davenant Institute is up to, I would say, is just incredibly essential. And anybody who's not looked into it should go, consider taking class. I think Timon has co-taught a class for us as well.
I've audited a class it was a great experience. I don't know if there's any other place you can go to that's doing what Davenant's doing the grad level seminar deep dives into the Protestant sources,
You didn't audit my class though, so you didn't get the full experience. But it's fine.
I got busy. Sorry, Tyler. One day. And I think I've said this before, but I mean, AMREF, our mission is confronting pressing issues of the day, drawing on the Protestant tradition, and that latter part, drawing on the Protestant tradition, has been incredibly encouraged and resourced by the work that Davenant does. There's a lot of Protestant reformers that could not be read in English, but for your work. And so obviously very, very grateful for that. And I mean, even some of the guys who are on the Cotton Mather syllabus, on the curriculum themselves, have really been resurfaced and enjoyed a revival because of Davenant's work.
Yeah, and so that actually kind of is a useful lead-in. I think it was when we cooked up the Cotton Mather Fellowship, it was sort of the tail end of the pandemic, I think. People were just kind of coming out of lockdown. And I think I'd written some things for the American Reformer Journal, and you and I had been talking on the phone. And the idea was, you know, one thing that it seems like there's missing in the Protestant ecosystem, we could say, is a sort of formative spaces for people who are young, but they're hoping to get involved in leadership, whether that's in seminaries or churches or Christian ministries or conservative movement industries, something that would be on parallel to things that exist in the Catholic, Roman Catholic world, you know. And so what would it look like to design a program, a summer fellowship, which would be, you know, one part gives them experience of doing some of the work behind the scenes of what goes on at American Reformer, whether that's, you know, more, you know, coalition building, you know, activist opportunities, or, you know, just editorial work. I mean, a lot of people are going to go on and become editors at a publishing house or writers in their own right or academics, and that experience could be instructive as well. So they get some work experience, but then also allow them to just kind of dip their toe into seeing all of these things that are true about Protestantism that most people never really get to see because it's just not taught in seminaries, right? I mean, Josh, I don't think you went to seminary. You did go to you got a graduate degree, right?
Yeah. I got a master's in Byzantine studies at Catholic University, so... Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's going to be a really different experience than what I think most seminary, you know, graduates get. You know, I've sometimes said that the average seminary nowadays in the US, you're lucky if about a third of it is sort of biblical studies and languages. And then about a third of it, you're going to have some level of sort of homiletics and counseling. And then a third of it is going to be sort of like salesmanship and, you know, business management structure. Those things are all probably really important and essential if you're going to become a leader of a church. But that's so different from the traditional historic curriculum that somebody would have had if they were going to become a leader of a church. And we know this in part, you know, how would most people know it? Crack open Calvin's Institutes. And I dare you to go through with a highlighter and highlight every time he cites either an ancient Roman or Greek pagan author, or every time he cites some scholastic source that nowadays we would consider, oh, well, that's a Roman Catholic thing. We can't talk about that. Now, I'm not saying he is a scholastic. I'm not saying he is a Greek or Roman pagan, but he's so deeply aware of these things and they help form his understanding of the world around himself. If you're going to become a leader in contemporary conservative circles, and I think you were just tweeting about this week, Josh, you look at the leadership of the conservative movement in the United States, and it's overwhelmingly Roman Catholic, but the voting base is overwhelmingly conservative Protestants. So why is it that the leaders are coming from this Catholic space? Well, in part, it's because they have an awareness of the relationship between things like metaphysics and ethics and politics and theology. And being able to step back and see those things in the same framework is really what we want to do when we're going through the curriculum of the Cotton Mather Fellowship. So we want you to see the depth of it, and we want you to see that it's actually related to the Protestant tradition intrinsically. So this isn't foreign to you. You can go read Aristotle. You can read Thomas Aquinas, and then you could read, you know, Thomas Traherne to realize that we have ethical thinkers who are adopting a sort of Aristotelian virtue ethics framework and figuring out how it fits with the Bible. You can read Aquinas on law, and then you can read Richard Hooker and realize that, you know, we have our own scholars who have wrestled with these questions and have perfectly consistent, normal, Protestant, Reformed ways of answering, you know, what is law and how does it relate to what we see in the Bible, you know, for the Jews, mm-hmm. and what we do when we're deciding should we drive on the right or the left.
Well, if I could just jump in there real quick too. I mean, so it's not just the, you know, understanding the continuity of your own tradition, right? Aquinas is mediated through Hooker, who's mediated to James Wilson, and that brings us to our own American context. And that's, you know, you can follow the citations, but the effect of that, as you're talking about Catholic, you both were talking about Catholic leadership in America, is a sort of self-confidence to assume leadership, you know, in various spheres, because of that grounding in your tradition and the understanding of your continuity, that you have something to say, and that it's your tradition, and you get to engage it and also engage the country in which it's landed. And I think the self-confidence of Catholics in their intellectual tradition is something that Protestants for a long time have been envious of, assuming that they don't have it themselves.
And as you said, I mean, this is actually sort of a new development. I mean, if you go back 100 years in the United States, it was much clearer that places like Yale or Harvard had some sort of connection to a historic or vestigial Protestant heritage. And they understood themselves that, you know, that way. You might have thought they were sort of modernist, you know, and they were going off the rails. A lot of people were predicting it. They were right. And yet the tradition was still there, and it was clear. You know, nowadays, I don't think anyone, unless you're aware of the history of higher education, would ever think about Harvard as a sort of Protestant bastion of learning.
So let's pivot a little bit to get into a little bit of the weeds about the design of the Cotton Mather Fellowship. And, you know, maybe just start by talking a little bit about the program structure. You know, what are the constituent parts? Why did you design it the way that it is?
Yeah. Yeah. So the Cotton Mather Fellowship is, you know, we're looking for young people who are hoping to take on some institutional leadership in the future. And we're looking for young men who are going to do that. It's a fraternal fellowship. And, you know, one reason for that is we think that ordination is for men. That's part of Protestant orthodoxy. Another part of it, however, honestly, it's easier to run. It's harder to run a fellowship where you're thinking about, if we're going to go away for a weekend, how are we going to house, you know, the men and the women, or where are they going to stay? So I think there's a variety of reasons. And then there's a sort of sociological reason that's behind both of those, which is just that, you know, men and women operate differently when they're in sex segregated spaces than they do when they're in blended spaces. And that's been pretty thoroughly documented, you know, no matter what culture you go to. You know, we wanted a space for politics to be hashed out in a way that it's going to be on an elder board, for example, in those types of spaces. So that's sort of who we're looking for. And then in terms of what we actually do, there's three components. So one is, like I mentioned, there's a work component. You're doing some stuff. You're sort of placed and housed somewhere inside of American Reformer, and you're doing some work alongside the team. And then there's a 10-week long course where you do a couple hundred pages of reading every week. Some supplemental reading of 200 pages sounds really light to you. But, you know, if you're not of the academic variety, 200 is enough. And then we get together for a call, and I'll offer some thoughts on it, and we'll open some space for questions. And then ongoing during the week, you'll be part of a group chat where you can ask questions about the text, or we can talk about ideas, or talk about the work, or talk about the news that's coming through the news cycle. And then towards the end of the summer, after those 10 weeks are done, we have a retreat. And the retreat is really, I think, the highlight, you know, of the summer for the Cotton Mather Fellows. You get together, and I think this year we're actually welcoming the former Cotton Mather Fellow alumni to come to the retreat if they're available. And I'll be there. I think for the last couple of years, you've been there, Josh, and we've had, I think, Ben Dunson, you know, Nate Fisher's been there. I think Jesse came last summer as well, out for a couple of days. And at the retreat, you know, we're praying together, we're reading scripture together, but we're also eating together and going for hikes together. And then we have a few last sessions where we have sort of class style seminars on texts that are relevant to sort of finish our thinking on what we're up to. So that's the structure.
Yeah. And the retreat's really essential. I mean, the maybe just get it on the table. This is something you and I discussed very early on, but this idea of building a fraternity, building a network of friends who, you know, a lot of them are working in different denominations. Not all of them are even pastors, right? Some of them are devout Christian men who are running businesses or in politics, but they're all people that we are sort of taking bets on. We think they're going to be, you know, men who are leaders in whatever domain they find themselves, and we want them to be leading from a fully, sort of fully engaged and educated Protestant faith. And so, you know, getting that, you know, that we have large, you know, we have a large chat group for everybody who's gone through Cotton Mather, and it's active, and people are sharing resources and comparing notes on various things, helping each other, coordinating on projects. And that's, you know, that's beautiful to see. It's part of the magic. And as we've gotten deeper into it and we start to have a real alumni network, it's really cool to see the successes, see the fruits of that fraternity being born, you know, in impact. But
And more so the farther in we get. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that's really exciting is, you know, I think like the first summer we tried it, it was sort of an experiment. And then last summer was our second summer. And by the end of the second summer, you realized, okay, these fellows actually really want to get to know each mm-hmm. other. There's a sense of like having gone through the same curriculum as a crew, you know, having hiked to the same waterfalls, these are experiences that, you know, you can connect over.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And let's maybe shifting from, you know, talking about that structure, talk us through a little bit of the curriculum. I mean, I know, you know, don't have to hit every book, but in broad strokes, what are people reading and why are they reading that specifically?
Yeah, so I would say the easiest way to think about it is since we have 10 weeks and then there's the weekend retreat, which is a bit of its own thing. But if you think about the 10-week curriculum, the first 5 weeks, we are really trying to think through Protestant sources and, as a supplement, what are the classical sources that those Protestant sources are sort of updating or very closely relating to or thinking alongside of. And so, you know, when we're doing that, obviously, because it's the Cotton Mather Fellowship, we have to read something from Cotton Mather. And so we read, Vile Poured Out Upon the Sea, which is a famous dialogue that he wrote about a sermon that he preaches to a pirate and trying to get this pirate to come around. And so Cotton Mather, we should probably say something about him, and maybe this is where Timon's gonna, you know, want to jump in and offer more thoughts than we have time for. I'm not a scholar of Cotton Mather, but he was a Puritan, and a pastor and a political leader. And a biologist. I mean, he was really a polymath, who was capable of a lot of things. And when we were initially running the fellowship, just by coincidence, there's a very famous scholar of Cotton Mather called Robert Middlecoff, who had just died, and he left his library of Cotton Mather literature to the institution that I teach at. And so I had all of these, you know, books about Cotton Mather. And I think you had recommended Cotton Mather, you know, independently, Josh. And so it was just sort of obvious that this is who we should pick. He's an all-American, you know, he's an extremely well-read hero of the sort of pre-revolutionary America, who really was doing his best to live up to Protestant orthodoxy. So I don't know, Timon, do you have any other thoughts on Cotton Mather before we jump back to the curriculum?
I have so many thoughts on Cotton Mather. All I will say is it's a great namesake, and I've put this in print at AMREF before, of, if, you know, one, he serves as, in many ways, the first, you know, American in the way we think of it, and as a sort of bridge between, you know, the patriarchs of early Massachusetts and, you know, what would become the American Republic. You know, Ben Franklin talks about going to Cotton Mather's office as a 14-year-old boy. So you have this connection between, you know, genealogically even between, you know, our country now and what really established it. And then just as a man of learning, I mean, you already kind of considered how he's a Renaissance man in many ways. But he's, you know, a thoroughgoing Christian. So the guy who's writing about the wonders of the invisible world and witchcraft is also the first American inducted into the Royal Society in London because of his scientific work. So it's this great, you know, bridge between the disciplines, but also an acknowledgement that learning, you know, does not destroy your sort of biblical and spiritual sensibility. So I think he's a perfect figurehead and namesake for the program.
Absolutely. And I'll just throw out there, he was one of the masterminds of the first revolution, the first American Revolution. So
That being the Glorious Revolution, indeed. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
So I had it wrong. It's not the first 5 weeks, it's the first 6 weeks. So really the majority of it is what we would consider magisterial Protestant sources. We're trying to get back to the origins, and you know, you're reading Cotton Mather, we throw a little C.S. Lewis in there, you're reading Calvin and Luther, Thomas Traherne, and we're pairing each of these things with a classical source. So when you're reading Calvin and Luther, you're reading Plato. When you're reading Thomas Traherne, you're reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. When you're reading Richard Hooker on natural law, you're reading Thomas Aquinas on natural law. When you're reading Althusius, you're reading Aristotle's Politics. And the goal there is, if you're going to be a well-formed leader, you have to think about ethics. Right? What is the good? You got to think about the law. What is law? How does it connect to what is good? You need to think about politics. How does one work as a group to affect the good in a just society? What is the just? These questions are really essential for anyone who's going to be a leader. And the Protestant tradition has a wealth of resources that answer those questions and that are self-consciously answering them in response to a tradition of classical thinking. And we want people to be exposed to that. That takes us to the second half of the summer, which is really about 4 weeks left. And in those 4 weeks, the goal, because, you know, we're a conservative Christian organization, we're hoping to make conservative Christian leaders. What I asked myself, and Josh and I had talked about it, and of course, these readings change a bit summer to summer, but what we really need to be able to read then is texts that are formational for the conservative movement at the moment, so that when these people who've been well-formed in the Protestant tradition go out and engage in, you know, the conservative movement, they know what people are reading or where they're coming from. And so you've got to read people like, you know, Leo Strauss, who's just, and it, you know, I mean, there was a period, at least during my earlier political lifetime, where I just felt like there was an endless stream of articles about how, like, you know, George W. Bush, and there was like, you know, Leo Strauss with little finger puppets behind him, sort of telling him what to do, because there were so many people who were informed by his philosophy who were connected to the administration. And so, you know, who is Leo Strauss? If you don't know, you're going to be less effective if you're getting into politics, if you're getting into academia as a conservative. You need to be able to identify these people and at least know a little bit about them. And so other people that we read are people like Josh Mitchell, right? His great book, American Awakening. And the one that's probably the most controversial that you know, people flip out when they find out about is Carl Schmitt. And so we read Carl Schmitt's On the Political, which is or The Concept of the Political, which also has a supplemental response by Leo Strauss. And, you know, why do we read it? Well, we read it because, look, people read Carl Schmitt. It's like, you know, you can act like the fact that he was a Nazi, the fact that he was collaborating with the Nazi regime, you know, disqualifies him from, you know, public, you know, opprobrium or from public engagement. You can act like that, but the fact of the matter is, if you go to, for example, the American Academy of Religion conference, and you look at who these people are citing, he's widely cited. You know, here's how I first came aware of Carl Schmitt's work. So my actual scholarship is on Aristotle's Theory of Friendship, right? And when you're reading Aristotle's Theory of Friendship, you're going to run into a bunch of people who are doing philosophy around friendship. And, you know, well, I'll be darned. Friendship, it turns out, has political implications. And this is something that is known all the way back to Aristotle, right? Aristotle says that political friendship, what he calls concord in a lot of translations, is a subset of the friendship of the useful. Okay, well, what does that mean? What it means is that there's some people with whom you basically kind of agree about how to live, and that's useful to you to have people who agree with you about how to live. But of course, that implies there's people who you don't agree with about how to live. What Carl Schmitt's doing in On the Concept of the Political is he's focusing in on that kind of friendship, this friendship of the useful that is called concord, or the agreement about how to live. And he's looking at the fact this implies there's people on the other side of that who you disagree with about how to live. And he's asking, what is that? And his theory is that that gives us politics. And, you know, you can kind of see how you would get there from Aristotle, because at the end of the Nicomachean Ethics, what does Aristotle say? He says, now that you understand, you know, friendship, which is the very end of the Nicomachean Ethics, he goes on for three books about friendship. He says, now it's time for us to talk about politics. And right at the beginning of politics, he begins by talking about, what is it? Political friendship, concord. So, you know, you can read leftists like Giorgio Agamben, and, you know, one of his students is essential. His writing is essential in my work on the philosophy of friendship. And, you know, look, you have to read Carl Schmitt and understand that there are people who think that political friendship is all the friendship that there is. There are people who think that way. We would say as Christians, that's wrong, right? There is a friendship with Christ, which transcends our incarnate enemies, which we always have, right? So everyone always has enemies. You can't avoid it. I mean, this is why Jesus says, right, pray for your enemies. You need to sort of work to love these people, because there's an awareness that our relationship to God does transcend that. And yet, an implication of that you just don't often hear, because it's not relevant to the preaching of the gospel, but it is relevant to your life here on earth, is the fact that you're going to run into people and say, not sure I agree that that's the way we should live, you know? And it's a really important question. Is this an ethical distinction? Sometimes. And sometimes it's just custom. It's just, this is how our community lives. This is how another community lives. Anyway, being aware of these things is, again, it's essential if you're going to go out there into the political world that we're in. And then the last one, we really don't get to this until we get to the retreat, but we spend an entire day. You know, I've taught classes on Nietzsche before. I love Nietzsche's writing. I think Nietzsche's really insightful. We spend an entire day reading about Nietzsche, thinking about him, and then thinking about how do these Protestant resources that we've been reading, how does Scripture call us to respond to this stuff? And you could again ask, well, this looks a little bit nefarious. You're telling me you take a bunch of guys out into the woods and you have them read Nietzsche, Colin? Well, why do we do that? We do that because, and you can ask any Cotton Mather fellow who's come through our program, we do that because the Nietzschean right is large and it's growing. And there's a lot of these guys who are out there in the internet. The internet's a great big sandbox and there's all kinds of people. And, you know, Nietzsche is insightful about many things, but ultimately he has a non-Christian understanding of the world. And we have to understand, how do you talk to these people? Why are they saying the things that they're saying? You know, when you hear something from one of these Nietzschean guys on Twitter, where are they coming from? And hopefully, God willing, we can win some of these people, right? I mean, some of these people can become Christian. That would be wonderful. I mean, that's my prayer for every non-Christian, is that they could come to a saving relationship with Jesus. But if you have no point of contact, if you have no understanding of where they're coming from, it's very hard for them to even hear you. And so there's a sort of evangelistic reason, as well as practically speaking, we want to equip our guys so that they don't fall into traps, right? Because some of the, you know, as Paul says in Scripture, right, some of the philosophy of the world are very seductive, and they're, you know, there are things that you have to be aware of, so that you can make sure that you, in your own heart, right, you're aligned with the Lord.
Yeah.
But if I could just jump in on the curriculum real quick. I mean, I think this is great because, you know, it's not just about, in my mind, recovering the content of Protestant sources in our tradition, which is very important, but also the sensibility of sort of the best people that we have to offer, which we could describe in many ways, especially in their scholastic mood, as having a sort of intellectual openness. One of my favorite professors I had was Mark Jones, and he would say, if you're a Reformed scholastic in the 17th century, you can cite Gandhi and Mother Teresa, and it's fair game, as long as you're making your point well, it doesn't matter. But you will read these sources, such as George Gillespie citing various Socinians or counter-Reformation Jesuits, which were much more offensive than Nazis, I'm sorry to say, at the time for a variety of reasons than we can imagine today. And he will say, look, they are right about XYZ, even though we know they're wrong ultimately in XYZ reason. But we can still use good arguments where we find them and good thinking where we find it. And it goes back to your point about Calvin as just being intellectually open and drawing from a variety of sources in order to, be compelling on multiple fronts of rhetoric. So I think this is a great intellectual exercise and an equipping sort of function that you're providing for the Compton Mather fellows to, really try to engage. It's not just that, Nietzsche is not offensive. It's certain things that Nietzsche thinks that might be wrong. But you can't, it's not good enough to just write off entire people because, the right people, quote unquote, are telling you it's bad. So I think this is good sort of mental fortitude that's being provided as well.
And we, I think as Protestants, we would say this is a tradition as old as the church, just as grace doesn't replace nature, it perfects it. So too, theology doesn't just abolish worldly learning. We don't stop doing science. We don't stop doing math. We don't stop doing philosophy. Somehow we have to subsume that and wrestle with it theologically. Josh, you were trying to jump in.
I was going to say, this is an important function that pervades the ethos of American Reformer totally. But, I think it's important as Christians who are, have access to seek to be deeply rooted in the Protestant tradition. Like, we cannot be scared of ideas, right? And this is, we need to look at ideas with very clear eyes. And, part of what's going on, I think, is that, these discussions with the Nietzschean right, they are happening. And the only question is, are you going to be in the room where they're happening? Are you going to be able to equip people with the right, with the counterarguments, the counterarguments that ultimately are winning counterarguments to the person who wants to subordinate their whole life to the way that Nietzsche would want them to run it? Yes, there are winning counterarguments. Mm-hmm. There, you can find them in our tradition. We can develop them together. But we're not, we're not scared. I mean, this is something about our journal as well, right? I mean, I think we're pretty unique in the extent to which we'll engage people on the Nietzschean right, engage them critically. I think that's a necessary function. I'm not sure anybody else is doing it. And, we need to be, I hope we're successful because I think that probably all of us to varying degrees are situated where we actually have an appreciation for the scale of the emerging strength of the Nietzschean right. It is an underground dynamic to some extent, but it's real and it's growing. And, just pretending it doesn't exist is not really an option for sober-minded Christian leaders.
Yeah. And, the kinds of options, which I think normal evangelicalism is sort of hoping to offer in response, I think they're going to find is woefully deficient. The sort of school marm-esque chiding is it's juvenile. And as Timon said, right? I mean, Augustine's not worried about what you think. He's going to read Plato and he's going to think about, Cicero, and he's going to cite these people and work through their arguments. And, he's going to come out the other side with a much stronger version, a much clearer, a much truer understanding of Christianity. And we see the exact same thing in Calvin. And any generation of genuine leaders in the church goes through that same process. And so I don't think, hiding your head in the sand and acting like Nietzsche didn't exist or like Schmidt didn't exist is not a serious option. And the only kinds of people who are going to take on political or economic or ecclesial leadership are serious people. And, and that's true even of people who you might be critical of. So I can imagine some of your listeners are probably pretty critical of Tim Keller. I don't know that for a fact, but I suspect. Tim Keller was a serious person. You might disagree with him about something. You might think his strategy was suboptimal. Well, if you want to do better, you have to become a serious person. Like, how much time are you spending sitting around complaining about the problems of Big Eva versus how much time are you actually spending reading and studying and working out and becoming the kind of excellent leader and finding the community of friends who are going to push you to become who you need to be if you're going to figure out what the strategy is for the next, you know, 10, 50, 100 years of the American church. Because that's what we need. We don't need like whining and navel gazing. We need people to be looking forward and pushing ahead and pushing one another to get there. That's at least my vision for Cotton Mather. That's what I want it to be. I think it's been relatively effective for the first couple of years, but we'll see where it goes.
Colin, that's a good segue. Let's shift over to talk about the design of the class. Tell us a little bit about who becomes a Cotton Mather Fellow. Who is this intended for?
Yeah, the Cotton Mather Fellows, like I said, are people who are hoping we're going to take on economic, political, and ecclesial leadership in, you know, the coming decades. And so we really have tried to find people who are in each of those spaces. Obviously, you know, you've got folks who are in seminary hoping to become pastors or leaders in denominations, guys like William Wolfe or Robert Hassler. And then you've got people who are hoping to go more into academia. You've got we've had a few Hillsdale grads, Ben Crenshaw, and we've got Andy Nassali, who's over at Bethlehem as well. You know, people who are hoping to either make an impact with their scholarship or become leaders in academic communities. And it tends to be those things work together, right? You don't become a leader in an academic community if you don't have a scholarly track record. And then you got people who are hoping to go into politics proper. And so, you know, I think Jack Waters is somebody who's working in DC and he's, you know, connected, into those networks out there. And then, Stephen Sills, who, had done a number of fellowships, and ours was one of the fellowships he did last summer. I think he was the leader of the Young Conservatives Club at Stanford before he graduated. He's going into law school and hoping for a career in politics. And so it really does span the gamut of those industries, as well as, you know, just straightforward business people. There's a guy who owns his own business down in LA doing, I think, you know, advertisements and film editing and things like that.
You know, and I think it's like a call. I mean, I love the way it's that you've designed it in the sense that, you know, it's a call to, I think partly to pastors to be engaging with and having their social network include these very strong, smart, faithful Christian brothers who are going into academia or going into economics or politics. I think having that, developing the fraternity between these different people is really important because, you know, I think too often, you know, the way that pastors tend to be trained in this country, they go off to seminary and then they go pastor a church. And a lot of ways they view their type of work in a way that's very, it can be isolating to them and separate them from what a lot of other Christian leaders are doing. And I mean, we're calling everybody in our program to be a polymath, to be a Cotton Mather in the sense that, you know, you can be a spiritual leader. Some of them will be very directly spiritual leaders, but also have, you know, be in that way a political leader as well. And be, you know, so, calling these guys to think more broadly about the range of leadership to which they may be called.
And I think young people who are going into pastoral ministry often, I mean, they often don't see that aspect of it. But when you talk to pastors who are my age, you know, I'm just in my early 40s. You've been in the saddle long enough to see the sort of loneliness that you have, because I think it's very hard. It is very hard to connect with your parishioners as a friend when you're a pastor. And so having a network of people who are not your parishioners, yeah, who you can reach out to, who you can rely on, I think it will pay great dividends in the future for those guys who do go into ecclesial leadership.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think we've already started hinting towards this, but what I mean, I think to kind of close this out with an exit question, what does success look like to you? What's the long-term vision of this program? You know, in 10 years, what do you hope we've accomplished through Cotton Mather?
Well, I mean, if we're as restrictive as we have been the last couple of years, I think we had five or six fellows the first year, eight fellows last summer. And I think we decided eight really is the sweet spot. We don't want to grow too much bigger than that because you lose the feeling of a sort of hothouse community of friends. You know, I think in 10 years, you've got a network. You've got 80 guys who are going to be between the ages in 10 years of about 40 and 25. And, you know, and then of course there'll be the old farts like, you know, you and I, Josh, who are a little bit beyond that. And I think it really will be an effective network, of political action, but also a sort of hive mind, a place where you can go to hear, okay, well, what is working on the ground? You know, I mean, I'm actually pretty sold on Ayn Rand's negative world thesis. I remember when I first heard it, when it was just like on a blog that he wrote, I was like, that's it. That's exactly what I've been experiencing. If you're in that kind of, if that's really what's going on, and we're going to move into, you know, some people have called it sort of post-Christian West, if that's where America's headed, at least for a season, you're going to need a closely networked group of people that you can trust, not just for survival, for economic survival, for job placements, for these kinds of things, but also epistemically, right? I mean, the culture is going to be saying all kinds of horrible things about you if you're going to be an Orthodox Christian. They already do that to some extent. And it, you know, do you think if you had to place a bet, is it going to get better or worse? Probably, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But you know, it's hard to resist believing what they say about you. You know, when they say it so constantly. And so a group of people who you can like, okay, here's what's going on. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what they're saying. What are you seeing? What is true? Obviously you need to go to scripture, but as we see in scripture, you go to scripture with the community of the saints, with the church. And this is going to give you access to that community of leaders, who's able to really, I think, you know, be an essential aspect of the web that's going to hold the church together. In the midst of the world that's coming into being.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's you're right on. I mean, that is exactly how I've thought about it as well. You know, from, you know, even just from the American Reformer perspective, you know, this is an investment, right? Why do we do this? We, you know, it's changing conditions, I think, require Christians to find each other, to be more efficient about building networks of influence and collaboration in a lot of different domains. And, you know, this is our humble way, admittedly, of starting that. And we're really starting it with leaders. And, you know, the process has gotten increasingly competitive, you know, to even kind of get into this program, which we're gratified by. But, you know, we wish we could take everybody. We can't. We have to do it well with a limited number. But the you know, we're just, I think we're very grateful and blessed. It's encouraging to see so many high capability, high energy young men, you know, seeking this kind of formation out, seeking out this kind of fraternity and going into, you know, leaving this fellowship, going into their line of work with, I think with clearer marching orders, understanding, you know, what it's going to take, for the church to prevail. But, you know, using kind of a wide array of tools, right? I mean, including, you know, political influence, economic activity, all of it. All of these various domains have to be rowing together in the coming years in a way that we had the luxury where we didn't have to coordinate as much 20 or 30 years ago, like we do today. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the hope. I mean, I think it's the one thing I've been surprised by throughout the pendency of this program is, you know, most of what we're reading is magisterial Protestantism. This is foundational stuff for our wing of the church, you know, like a third of Christianity.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just don't read it. Even people who go to seminary or grad school, most people have not read the stuff we're walking them through. And, you know, to the extent that they're going to go into circles in political leadership, you're going to be around, you may very well be around like very devout Catholics who had Aquinas and all these other scholastics pounded into their head from the time they were like in high school, you know, and they're just super sharp, super intellectually confident. We need that, you know, we're not in a phase of our society where we're going to get acclaim merely for showing up and being a nice Christian. We've got to be fully rooted in Scripture, and then the Protestant tradition that interprets Scripture for us, and you know, gives us a lot of gives us very helpful ways to understand the challenges we face. But yeah,
and I'll say one other thing about it, which is you know, it's probably worth noting that speaking of sort of what people call you, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, American Reformer, they're the Christian nationalists. It's like, okay, yeah, you can be a Christian nationalist and write for American Reformer and hang out at American Reformer. And you could be a Christian nationalist and come and do the Cotton Mather Fellowship. And I want to say that. I also want to say, you don't have to be. I've often said, you know, it's not what they call you, it's what you respond to. You know, I don't identify as a Christian nationalist. But I'm in agreement with the magisterial Protestant tradition of, and their understanding of the two kingdoms, and the way to read Scripture. And I think that's not something they came up with. I think they got that from Scripture. And I think they're in agreement with the patristic sources. You read Augustine, you know, Eusebius, there's plenty of people who are writing in this way. So that is just to say, if you don't know what these terms mean, if you're somebody who's like, I've got my Scripture, I go to church, I know I believe in Orthodox Christianity, I think I have a calling to be a leader, I would encourage you to apply. That would be that. That's all I wanted to say. That's why I was jumping in.
Yeah, no, that's spot on. I mean, I don't even know, like,
I can teach you Richard Hooker and Thomas Traherne, you know what I mean? I don't need somebody who's already a scholar of that stuff.
For that matter, I mean, we've always had very heavy Baptist contingents, some of whom, you know, don't go all the way with the magisterial Protestants in some areas. You know, that's welcome. I mean, we want serious Christian men who are going to wrestle with the texts that we go through and are basically on board with the general project of how do we wield, steward the leadership we've been granted in a way that serves the church. And, you know, that everybody has that shared understanding. But once you get past that, there's a lot of room for, you know, I would say highly constructive, highly helpful Socratic exchanges. You know, Christian nationalists, I don't know, maybe a quarter of our fellows are Christian nationalists. I don't know. You know, I don't know the numbers. We don't track that.
I mean, they probably change over time. I have no idea. And honestly, it doesn't matter. It's like, you know, that's a, it's just a term in the ether.
Right. I mean, I think the most important thing again is people who I would say feel a compunction. They feel compelled to seek out the intellectual footing. They know they need it. They know that the leadership to which they've been called requires them to get sharp on these issues. And so, it's been a pleasure to help, to watch from a distance for AMREF to invest in the program that you've built, Colin. And, you know, I think, you know, for those who are listening, really welcome your applications. I think, you know, everybody who's gone through has had rave reviews about the experience and has been very grateful for the formation. So, you know, if you're, you know, a younger Christian man, call it, you know, early to mid-career, you know, please do consider this an option. You'll be surprised. We take people from a lot of different backgrounds, you know, who show aptitude for leadership. And so, if you're in doubt, throw us an application. We would heartily welcome it.
Well, it's a real honor getting to do it, and it's been a joy for the last couple of summers. I deeply enjoy being on the group chat with these younger guys, you know, hearing their perspective on the state of the world, the state of academia, and, you know, it confirms a lot of theories that I have about what's going on out there. But it gives me sort of firsthand evidence.
Yeah.
So,
and you know, sorry, I could go talk about this all day, but one of the magic things that happens when you get this group together is, you know, last summer we had this, you know, we had a guy who, you know, recently come through Stanford, head of the Young Republicans, I think at Stanford, right? Like, very sort of front lines at the vanguard, the tip of the spear in, you know, fighting leftists in a big institution. You know, and then you've got somebody who's, you know, maybe a pastor of a large church who's come up his entire life through Christian institutions, Christian college, Christian seminary, pastors of Christian church. And there's really, really wonderful sharpening and cross-pollinization that happens when you get those two guys together. And so, you know, that is, it's part of the magic. I mean, we kind of, when we design the classes and look over the applicants. That's part of what we're looking for, is like, how do we get people who are going to, you know, they've read different stuff, they've had different formative experiences, and it's going to create a spark of energy in terms of, you know, new information getting transmitted between these people. So
we're big fans of diversity, yes, at the Cotton Mather, yes, Fellowship.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Yes. All rightly understood, of course. Rightly understood.
Right, right, of course.
Yeah. Well, Colin, I think with this, we can probably call it a wrap. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks for your work on this fellowship program.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what kind of applicants we get this summer. Hopefully, we'll see some of you, listener.
Yes, yes, indeed. All right, audience, thank you for joining us today. As always, please do follow us on Twitter. That's at Amory Former. Check us out at AmericanReformer.org. If you like this podcast, leave us a rating and a written review. That always helps.
Well, Josh, before we closed out, I wanted to make a special never-before-heard announcement that I myself may be at the Cotton Mather's Retreat this year for the first time. This should be a major draw for all applicants, and so I expect to see our applications boom over the next few weeks upon hearing this.
All right, wonderful. Thank you for letting us know, Timon. You know, that may be a draw or a repellent, as the case may be. We'll see. Thank you, gentlemen and audience, this time for real. Until next time, God bless.
You can find American Reformer on the internet at www.americanreformer.org. or on X.com, formerly Twitter, at AM Reformer. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Please consider supporting us today by making a tax-deductible donation through our secure online donation portal at AmericanReformer.org. That's AmericanReformer.org.